Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
What does a good story make? You work with so many writers over the years. If you were to paint us a picture of an ideal presentation, let's just say you have a client whose story you're helping communicate through third parties, what does a perfect story look like in your eyes?
Well, the perfect kind of story that checks all these boxes to mm-hmm. I'm going to buy you for the first time. I think the package is part of the it's like the cover of a book.
Of course.
You know? Mm-hmm. So if you have this, it helps because you can't read everybody's story. And some of the brands are named after people. So to me, if that's the route that you would have, at least you can go for the, tell me about this person and why do I care? I'm mm-hmm. the consumer. And the old world, in very many ways, was always about the place. Chateau XYZ.
Excellent point.
No one would ever have asked, and they still don't ask, who's the winemaker? Who tell me about this family that's owned this property. So if you have authentic, non-made up, and Rambar is a good example. Irma and Kerner were awesome folks, and she was famous because The Joy of Cooking was the most important cookbook in our lifetime.
Yes, still being printed.
Still being printed. It was one of the first ones as a young person that I picked up because it had everything from A to Z in it. Not that Julia Child's book, which I also own and bought early, wasn't good, but you know, when that brand became available, there was something about that that it was authentic, it was real. She cooks, therefore, you know, the kind of connecting dots.
Yeah.
And if you can connect 3 or 4 or 5 dots in less than a few seconds. Mm-hmm. Or a few minutes. I mean, I've seen people hang out in walls of wine all across the country. You get focused by getting to the point. And if you're a Cabernet house and you make Rutherford Cab, and the price fits, and it has a review or two, but frankly, one is good. And if there's something that you do that's, maybe it's not that unique, but it's a sum of the parts. Mm-hmm. So if you're a husband and wife and your daughter's making the wine now and you've been farming the land for 3 generations or 30 years or whatever, and it's only, you know, $25 investment. And price is kind of important, I think. It's an important component. You don't want to be too cheap because then you're just automatically thought of as an industrial wine. Mm-hmm. Probably not a great word for wine, but there's plenty of examples of that. And I've worked for many of those kind of companies. And that's fine. It's just like people are happy to dine at, I can't use any examples that I've been to recently, but whether it's Applebee's or other popular price places, they're happy to go to Red Lobster. They're happy to go to Olive Garden. They're happy to do the Applebee's Chick-fil, whatever. You know, there's this tier of spending. Mm-hmm. Be who you are. Be authentic. Own it. You're not trying to be, you know, a 92-pointer from whomever. Mm-hmm. Just want to be a really great value, good wine, something that people can drink Monday through Thursday. And then those producers, of which there are many, that make that kind of wine, it's not like a big investment. Going back to Consumer Reports. Yeah, I'm going to spend a lot of money on a washer dryer. I want to get the best one, or a stereo, or a car, or whatever. But when it comes to wine, it's subjective. It's like art. It's like movies, you know. How many times we've gone to the movies and it's been recommended by our friends. Got the little man in the Chronicle standing on his chair, and it puts us to sleep. So maybe our reviewer isn't in line with our love of something. I've had a handful of wines over the years from friends of mine that are famous reviewers, and you know, I just don't like them as much as they do. And I'm sure I like certain things that they might not like. And you know, if you subscribe to the notion that there's three kinds of palates, you know, like low, medium, and high, tolerant, intolerant, in the middle. That's why bitter things and sweet things have different impression on you. So if you say, hey, this is not dry, this is off dry, or let me know it's sweet. Sweet red blends are selling like hotcakes. Excuse me.
No worries.
Why is canned wine so hot right now? People love the idea that could have a bottle of wine in a can, take it with them without the weight. And I always say, hey, make sure you pour that in a glass because it's going to be better. But it's
good tip.
It just pour it in a glass. We didn't mean you to drink it out of a can. Okay. but if you talk to any of the buyers for any of the big chains in America, canned wine is the hottest thing they are selling right now. And only because they look at percents. It's not yet a big dollar contribution like some of the large brands. You know, when you think of KJ Chardonnay and I'm just throwing brands out, you know, something like BV Cabernet, KJ Chardonnay, Meiomi Pinot Noir. These are big numbers. And everybody doesn't like them, but enough people like them that they're selling a shitload of them.
Absolutely.
You know, and all of those kind of brands that got famous for consumer appreciation usually do pretty well for a long time. Their job is to keep that buzz and that aggregate love. One of the ways to do it, from my strategic counsel, is pick some wine competitions that you think will help you and that you'll do well in. And if you do well in a few of them, you have a good example of that wine. And you can do that all day long and not rely on a Wine Spectator score, let's say. But it doesn't hurt for the trade to have that. Because some retailers, some sales that have been doing it a long time, they got to have something that has a number on it. Just makes their job a little bit easier. And I don't think it's lazy. It's just that that's their, if it's seeing a lot of eyeballs, and let's just say you got a 92 on something that costs $15. And you see that every once in a while. I'd go and buy a case of it. When I don't need any, you know, I mean.
So that's a call to action.
That's a call to action.
Clear value.
Because you know they're going to run out of that vintage.
Yeah.
It's less common in the spirits business. And I think it's because, hey, you know, it's vodka, it's bourbon, it's whatever it is, tequila. Very, very different. I love tequilas, especially Blanco tequilas. You could taste 400, I probably tasted 400 of them. They're all different. They're just all different. You taste Napa Valley Cabernets. Some of them are oddly close to each other.
That's an extraordinary comment. It really is, because people think of Blanco tequila as something that is, you know, theoretically somewhat similar.
Right.
And of Cabernet because it's a variety, and it's because it's grown in different places, different conditions. There's a whole bunch of variables that go into that. That would have to be different again on paper.
Both agricultural kind of products.
Yeah, I mean agave grows in different areas and different there's human varieties. Touch and yep, different yep. varieties. Yep. So everything applies. That's totally a fascinating subject.
But the thing that it was distilled in is yeah. part of why blue agave is going to taste different. It's the process. It's the are they using a stone to grind the piña after it's been steamed? Do they steam or do they bake? You know, they use convection, you know, and you kind of go down this path. And just like you don't know if you could see and taste a bunch of Chardonnays and you don't know a lot about processes, you know, indigenous yeast, you know, or special, excuse me, yeast. Mm-hmm. You know, how long does it sit on skins if it's a red wine?
Absolutely.
There's a hell of a lot of different variables where you think that they'd be more different and they're not. In my personal opinion, when I get to taste a bunch of wines that are in the same category. And I've done that enough times to have an opinion about like certain categories, like Pinot Grigio Gris. You know, there's a sameness to them oftentimes. Even if they're all good, your hope is you're trying to find something great. That's sort of the real goal of a judge. And I'm sure a reviewer thinks the same way. Is that, you know, I want to find the two or three things in this pile of 20 that are just awesome and great and that I would recommend that someone go out and find. And then you discover later, oh my goodness gracious, what a nice price too. So that's part of it is in the coffee world, when we go into Pete's, we could order a little espresso made from all the different ones, different countries, New Guinea, Central America, etc. And you'd find two or three that you really preferred. I'm sure of it. And I've done some olive oil judging, not professionally, but that's another one of those. Oh my goodness. And every time we get low on olive oil at home, I always go buy four or five, maybe local or maybe somehow different. And the story is part of it because I read somewhere that Uruguay makes a really good example of one. And the Garzon guys that make wine, they actually were making olive oil before they were making wine. And you compare that, tend to not be too popular price, tend to be a little higher, but when you're dipping bread or you're finishing, it's a finishing oil and you're trying different ones. It's like, I love having different salts to play with at dinner time. Same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. You guys that are listening, you just got absolutely fantastic advice. Whatever it is that you're after, gives yourself some options. Go and pick instead of one thing off the shelf that happens to be there, just buy several and, you know, just do a little tasting. Do a little self-exploratory exercise. It's so gratifying, isn't it? You kind of get to know yourself through that physical medium at this point. It's like, oh, I didn't know I liked this gray salt versus pink salt. I don't know why, but it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
You know, your palate is clearly as informed as it gets. And what you touched upon earlier, I really want to flesh out a bit more, which is the world of judging and the world of reviewing is somewhat enigmatic to an average consumer. You know, they see the words, I mean, though they read the words, and, you know, they're obviously somewhat intimidated because they don't speak that language. It's not something that they're familiar with. But yet they're so, as you described earlier, they're so wedded to it when they develop an interest in it because it's something that helps them wrap their mind around the products that they wish to purchase. With someone with your breadth and depth of knowledge and experience, picking out these gems from thousands of entries in front of you, How does that process work? What makes a specific wine, a spirit, talk to you in a language that makes you excited, that makes you feel like you should reward it? What are the qualities that you look for?
That's a good question, and it is true that only a small percentage of the consumer, because I'm a consumer, I just am lucky I get to be an evaluator from time to time. And I know that folks that do it for a living, it's an arduous task. And when you start with this clean sheet of paper.
Yeah.
And all of it's associated with bias too, because and I've said this many times, and many of my winemaker friends know that I feel that they have a little bit of a narrow view on wine because they're exposed to whatever they're exposed to. Someone like myself, I'm fortunate because I get exposed to global wines, and in some cases, wines that aren't commonly viewed as benchmark wines. So if you're making wine here in Napa and Sonoma, you're probably not looking at Paso Robles.
Very good point.
You're probably just looking at your brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
Your neighbors, the people that are here. Step one is think of typicity. And when you have a category and you know nothing other than you're going to have 30 Cabernets today, followed by 10 Rieslings, followed by 20 Syrah, followed by, and most of us get about 100. So they take the, like in San Francisco, which I've done for more than 20 years, everybody gets 3 days to come up with their favorites with a panel. And what the real fun is when you take turns saying what you want, what you gave it. So you got these 10 Cabernets, or, and when I'm struck when I sniff them, Dr. Peterson taught me a lot. Find the ones that smell wonderful, pull them forward. So don't necessarily, if you can get a flat out like that, it's the same thing that production guys do in, after harvest. They sample every single barrel, every single batch, and they pull them forward or push them back, creating a 1, 2, and 3 effect. Favorite, second favorite, third favorite. Maybe not so much that we even like that one. Don't spend much time on that. There's a reason why you did that. Your first impression is either a wow or a, oh yeah, that's good. Or it's, you know, there's something that's just not quite here, you know, and you push it away from you. Then you end up with 3 or 4 out of 10 that are here, in closest to you. And then you kind of play with those. I'm a very big spitter. I believe in spitting. Known David Stevens taught me how to double spit so that you could feel wonderful at the end of the day. And that holds true for whiskey too, and other products that are much stronger. You don't want to swallow any of it. Even at a stand-up tasting, I want to get through as many wines as I can. And the only way to do that is give it a great sniffy sniff, usually 3 times, you know, let it roll around in your palate and then let it go out and then start writing things down. And I'll write things down that may be fruit oriented, maybe earth oriented. Maybe there's something about it that put me into a terrible descriptor. And normally those wines don't get written about or talked about, because that kind of puts it in a funny spot. And so we all come up with, Doug Frost said it the best, they're all part of the aromas of our youth. And when you were little, you were born with no memory of things. And then there are certain things that you taste and spit out. Might have been baby food that was not a category that you're liking, right? As you get older, you have your cooking that your mom and dad do, and there are certain things that you have really fond memories of, and then there are certain things that weren't all that terrific. So you start this bias in early in your life of flavors. And I know people that go, cantaloupe? Nope, it's not my thing. But I like this kind of melon. And vice versa. I know there's a percent of public that hates cilantro because it's soapy to mm-hmm. them. We all have a different thumbprint. We all have a different way of putting it all together. But they were taught to us to some extent when we were little. And so oftentimes when I'm in the fruit market, I smell things because I just all I'm doing is reestablishing my knowledge of a white peach versus a yellow peach.
Yeah.
You know, what's the difference taste profile on a Bing cherry versus a Queen Anne or something? I mean, you try different things. And to me, Sauvignon Blanc, for example, Cabernet, they all have typicity. What makes a good one? Maybe it's a three or four things. But that's just the beginning. What happens after that is the texture, the body, the kind of, breaking apart the, mm-hmm. whether it's 100 point or 20 point or however many points you want to use. Mm-hmm. I kind of go lower number of numbers is better for math purposes. And that's why you pull a few forward. You just like the apple in this one. I like the pears. And this one has mandarin oranges for some reason. And with those categories, that typicity is pretty well agreed upon. Mm-hmm. Generally, we're not tasting old wines.
No.
We're tasting fairly young wines. As they get older, I'm looking for different sort of love.
Yeah.
And I know you and I have both been fortunate enough to try an older bottle of a well-made Bordeaux, Burgundy, Tête de Cuvée, Champagne, Napa and Sonoma. I've been fortunate to taste 50 vintages of Beaulieu Vineyard.
Oh my goodness.
George de la Tour, all in one sitting. And I can tell you that out of all that, in your brain, somewhere there's a vintage it stuck out to you.
Yep.
Or Inglenook, before things got sold to the current owner. God, the 47, I mean, you just think about that one vintage that was an aha moment and you went, God, that's like perfect.
And you knew it at first impression.
You knew it right off the bat. And then it was confirmed by the gargling process. And then how much you thought about it after you spit it out, too. The length on it. And then if you're lucky, you might even be at somebody's house where there's a lot of bottles open. One time at Daryl Groom's, he had a whole bunch of Grange open. And I remember thinking, God, this one from 78 or something was just doing it for me. Not that I don't like young wines. I actually prefer young wines. Mm-hmm. But I've been to the New York Wine Experience 30 times. Sometimes you get real lucky. You're in the audience with, 900 of your best friends. And you're tasting Lafite or Mouton or maybe it's all five first growth. Mm-hmm. And they bring whatever vintage they want to bring because they donate it.
Yeah.
And you're just struck by certain things that,
yeah.
And that's going to stick with you for the rest of your life. Just like as you are aging, you think about companions, males or females that were your friends. Maybe they were your girlfriends. Maybe they were a test spouse. Maybe they, whoever they were in your life, there were things about each of these people. They had personalities that you liked. And there might have been some things about them that you didn't like as much. And wine to me, it's not about price. And it's not about where it came from or who made it. It's about being in that moment, in that glass, you know, nice 10-year-old something or other. Or drinking old Chardonnay, where you go, holy crap, I like older Chardonnay, if it's made from these guys. Because apparently that recipe that they have, and generally each house, no matter what country, you know, maybe they can age their white wines. Daryl Cordy always has old Rieslings, you know, German Rieslings, and there's nothing like, you know, a 30-year-old Riesling. And then you say, gosh, I just want some shellfish here. Come on, let's go. Yeah. And you like playing in this game of, we're lucky. We get to taste all sorts of things.
Yeah.
But in the review process and in the competitions, it's generally new or newish. And you're just picking for typicity and what your expectations are. You're also lucky to be with other people that have tasted a lot. And generally, amazingly enough, you know, you'll be with, you know, a buyer from Safeway. I taste a lot with Wilfred. You got a nice little crowd of four people, you know, and everything just goes smooth. Because everyone's had their experiences, and when a good one shows up in this little segment of 8 at a time, 9 at a time, 10 at a time, mm-hmm. there's always one, hopefully. Sometimes there are two, maybe there's three, that just strike you, that go, they knew what they were doing. I'm going to hang on to this one because that's my new benchmark. And also competitions, I always say, well, how come, people say, how come I got a gold over here and over here I got a bronze? And I went, because they're all different, they're at different times and with different people. If you could track 10 judgings of your Chardonnay and it did well most of the time, that's a great wine. Even if I wasn't involved at all. If I see that, because there's actually a spreadsheet that you can find. California Grapevine prints it at the end of the year. And you'll see the top Chardonnays and the top Cabernets that won the most golds. And if you're, and then that last column is my favorite column. It's got the price. If you can buy a highly awarded wine over multiple judgings, that's, you know, $25 to $30. My sense is, oh, you probably ought to get a case of that. And most of the higher end things don't enter. These phantom wines or luxury wines that are, you know, $200, $300, $400 a bottle, mm-hmm. they're not represented in the competitions. Mm-hmm. And there are many brands here in Napa that have never submitted a bottle for review because they don't really need to. And they might send it off to the Wine Advocate and Lisa, and they might send it off to the Spectator and see what happens. Mm-hmm. But they already got a mailing list. They already have image.
Do you suppose that there could be a negative effect if the...
Yes.
Yes, of course.
If
an expensive wine...
Everything to lose. Hey, if I was brand manager at Opus One, I wouldn't enter any of them either. Just to use them as an example.
Sure.
Because there's no need to, you know. And as a chief judge in three competitions, I don't really expect those wines to show up. There's a 500,000 SKUs out there. There's plenty to get sent in. And it's not uncommon that, you know, folks that are making wine in that $10 to $30 range, that's where all the competition is.
I mean, yeah.
That's where you're vying for shelf space or for a spot on a list with a young sommelier.
Yeah.
And you get the wine by the glass by having the distributor having a good deal on five cases. I mean, how do you get into the wine by the glass business is very price oriented and very quality. If you have good quality wines, even if no one's ever heard of you. It works in restaurants because you have a spokesperson in the restaurant. And then that person has all these servers. And I always say to the server, I mean, even though I don't need to ask all the time, but I'm in a place that's making great food, I always ask the server.
That's really interesting. In that same vein, you know, the sommelier community has, there's been really quite an explosion. That profession has grown exponentially, and there's certainly kind of the first line of communication in the restaurant to a guest, so a hugely important role. What are your thoughts on this community? What are some of the triumphs and some of the perils as you've observed it?
Because the curiosity, it's about curiosity. Mm-hmm. A lot of young sommeliers and many ones that have been at it for a long time remain curious.
Huh.
To me, that's the perfect storm. People that are curious, trying new things. When you do a work with and you call on the accounts with a distributor salesman, or even if you're doing it because it's your brand, you know, they give you this much time, 10 minutes, tell your story, make it quick, elevator pitch, write what you need to write on an index card that's 3x5. Don't tell them what it got in the Wine Advocate or the Wine Spectator or the Wine Enthusiast, because they don't care. They're going to ask you, how much does it cost a case? Mm-hmm. And if I pour it by the glass, do I get a better deal? They'll might also ask, do you have supply? Do you have tons of it or do you have a little of it? Sometimes having a little of it's good. Not too long ago, I was at the Girl and the Fig. I saw a Grenache Blanc on there, and I said to the server, I said, is this a good Grenache Blanc? And she said, yeah, we have all of it. Well, they only made it 4 barrels, right? So understanding where their food is, what kind of food, flavors, ingredients, what might go best with those foods. Mm-hmm. And knowing that when you call on them, they're curious. They're more curious than you are, probably, about regions and about varietals. And they may have you got to look at the list they already have put together. What are their, you can tell by looking at a list where they're going, you know, and what they're trying to do.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.